Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. I'm David Hellman, contributing book reviewer for the San Francisco Chronicle and a librarian at San Francisco State University, and I'm here with author Myla Goldberg.
That was good. That sounded very professional, very, you know, radio ready. I think we're
great. I'm trying. I got a little script here. 3 years ago, the Decembrists, and everybody here should know who the Decembrists are, right? Colin Molloy wrote a song about Myla Goldberg's pretty hands and dangly limbs as unique New York. With her first novel, Bee Season, Goldberg, who plays the banjo, won the adoration of brainy girls and boys everywhere. Bee Season is weird and lovable in its spelling bee awkwardness and became a major motion picture. Her follow-up, Wicket's Remedy, about the 1918 influenza epidemic, is fascinating. It combines years of intense research and fictional commentary of ghosts who offer their own funny interpretations of the story. Please welcome Myla Goldberg. So, Myla, I have a bunch of questions here for you.
Oh, boy.
And hopefully I haven't lost them in the process. Okay, first of all, I have to ask the obvious question. I think everybody wants to know, why the banjo?
Two reasons. The first being Kermit the Frog. And, you know, when he sings the Rainbow Connection in the Muppet movie, I saw that and it just stole my heart. And then that was compounded by Harold and Maude when Harold is walking around strumming it. And that really is what got me into it. Although I ended up learning old-timey clawhammer Appalachian-style banjo, which is sort of different than either Kermit or Harold plays.
And you also play accordion, correct?
I do. I do play accordion.
And I want to just point out that she's in a very interesting band in Brooklyn, New York, called the Walking Hellos. Everybody should check them out. They're quite fun. Now, do you see a relationship between your creative works as a writer and a musician? If you had to, could you choose between the two? And if
no. Why? Well, I mean, I had to make that choice. I mean, I did make that choice in a way. I mean, I've always played music, like ever since I was a little kid, and I've always written ever since I was a little kid. And it was in college where those sort of competing interests came to a head, and I realized that if I wanted to do one really well, I would have to kind of devote most of my energies to one and let the other be a hobby. And if I had kind of divided myself between the two, they would both just kind of be, you know, halfway efforts. And I realized in college that my ambition lay with my writing and that just my happiness lay with the music. And that could be just like a hobbyist thing and it would be okay. But it's always been a part of, you know, who I consider myself as my identity. And I think they definitely... they feed each other, but not in a way that I can put my thumb on or like really pinpoint. I think they're sort of, they balance each other out because writing is a very, very megalomaniacal process. It's just me and my little world in my room, you know, and it's very solitary. But with music, for me, it's the collaborative aspect of music that makes it so rewarding. So it's a totally different kind of creativity. And then in another way, I think music is a part of writing for me because I'm very sensitive to how words sound when they're put together, and the assonance and the meter and the cadences all kind of, I think, tie into the fact that I also consider myself a musician. So,
do you actually listen to music while you write?
No, I really can't. Well, I mean, I think hypothetically I might be able to listen to music without words, but I've never really tried it. But lyrics just will totally derail me, so usually I just want quiet.
Great. You answered this a little bit, but I hope you can go a little farther with it. If you had to write an autobiography of a writer, what would be the first line? In other words, how did you become a writer? What was the genesis of your craft?
Oh, the autobiography, not the autobiography, another writer, my autobiography.
Your autobiography as a writer.
I was born a poor black child. I don't know. I have not given any thought to anything like that. I mean, I guess the one thing I've always known, I mean, I always knew I wanted to write. And so I'd probably want to start off by just saying, you know, it was always there. As soon as I can remember thinking about anything that I wanted to do, it was always writing. And sometimes that would compete with wanting to be a champion ice skater or like an archaeologist when I was like really little and like was dinosaur obsessed or something. But writer was always in there as well. And like while other kids would play house or whatever, I would sit at an electronic typewriter and pretend I was writing a novel. So, you know, it was pretty early on.
Great. Most writers do not have the kind of success that you had with your first novel. What wisdom can you share with us about the instant success, celebrity, and what did you do to Oprah that kept her from choosing Bee Season for her book club?
It was a total shock. I mean, I guess no one can like count on or think that they're going to be a big success or anything. But I didn't even think Bee Season was going to get published. I mean, I had already written a novel before Bee Season that had gotten me my agent, and we'd spent a year and a half collecting extremely kind rejection letters, and then no one had wanted it, and I'd put it in a drawer. And I was expecting Bee Season to do the exact same thing, and I was steeling myself to just write novel after novel. And maybe at some point when I was, you know, middle-aged, I'd finally find one that someone wanted to publish. And so it getting published was a big enough thing, but then it just becoming so successful is just a total, total shock. And I guess one thing that was important, and I think because it just kind of came out of the blue, I always figured that, well, it came out of the blue, and this is my one time, like, lightning struck, but, you know, don't count on anything like this ever happening again. And so just, like, not changing how I thought about writing or something based on that, I think, was a big key. Because I think it'd be easy on another level to say, okay, well, how can I write something just like that? Because that was great. I want to write another really big, successful book. And I think that's a way to destroy the writing process. Like, it's so important, to, for my mind, to think about a process and not a product, and just to follow where my heart leads me and what I'm interested in doing, rather than try to reverse engineer something that, you know, well, I think might appeal to some hypothetical, you know, reader.
Thank you. Now, you you have a young daughter at home, and has this changed how you work? Do you have any advice for others in a similar situation? And for the record, I'm asking for myself.
Well, I mean, I'm very, very lucky in that regard. I've been able to, since Bee Season, I've been able to be a full-time writer, which means I get to basically dictate my own work schedule. And so that's allowed me to have more time, I think, to spend with my daughter than most people get, because, you know, trying to balance a job and, you know, a kid and everything else, it's basically impossible. And so I have the luxury of being able to set my own hours, and my husband also works at home, and it means that we both get to spend a lot of time with her, which is really fun. But I guess the one thing I can say is I'm an extremely disciplined person. I have a very, very fascistic schedule that I follow religiously every day of the week that allows me to get in, you know, 6 hours at least of writing before I do anything else. Or maybe, like, I do my writing in the morning and then I get to do other stuff. Or I write in the afternoon, but nothing, you know, you've got to stay really, really focused, I think, to get stuff done.
Great. I heard that you've been working on a children's book. What can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. It's done, actually. It'll be out next year. It's called Catching the Moon, and it's about this old fisherwoman who is fishing at night, and no one knows why. And in the process of the book, you learn that she's fishing for the moon because she wants to talk to the moon about the tide that's been eating away at her shack. And so in the course of the book, you find out how that actually goes, this whole trying to catch the moon business. It was totally fun to do.
Oh, that's fabulous. Yeah. My son's favorite word is moon.
Really?
So we'll definitely get a copy of that.
It'll be out next year, so okay, don't go looking in a bookstore immediately.
Okay. Bee Season and Wicket's Remedy share some similar themes, and I'll ask you about those later. But they are also very different books in their approach, tone, and execution. It's almost as if they were written by two different writers. Please tell us what you can about the process that led you to write Bee Season and how, if at all, that process changed when you started to work on Wicket's Remedy.
Well, that's actually one of the best compliments I can possibly hope to hear, that they felt like they were written by different writers. Because when I set out to write Wicket's Remedy, before I even knew what my second book was going to be, I knew I wanted it to be as humanly different from my first book as possible. And the reason for that is the writers that I admire most are the ones who are always, always pushing pushing themselves in new directions and trying to do new stuff. And then also it has to do with the fact that I consider this writing thing like a long-term career for me. And if I try to do lots and lots of different things now, it means that, you know, when I'm this hunched old biddy over my keyboard, I've got this huge toolbox of different, you know, writerly things that I've tried my hand at. And so I can hopefully approach absolutely anything I want to and maybe actually do a good job of it. So I knew I wanted it to be very different. And the themes that came up in Common wasn't through any conscious effort or thought on my part. I think that's just what happens. I think most writers, if you start reading their work, you'll find that some common threads run through their work. And hopefully, if they're doing their job, it doesn't get boring. Like some writers, they just kind of harp on the same, the absent father, book 2, 5, 7, the absent father, and it gets a little boring. And so I mean, the challenge is, once you start having these kind of obsessions and these interests, to hopefully explore new facets of them or put them in a new light. And then there was something about bee season informing this, the other part of your question I've totally forgotten. What was it?
Well, don't worry, we'll just move on. what was involved in the research process in preparing to write Wicket's Remedy? How, if at all, did this change the actual writing process for you?
Well, yeah, I mean, the biggest challenge for me, well, not the biggest, but one of the biggest challenges, because everything about writing Wicket's Remedy was a challenge, basically. Bee Season, for anyone who's wondering out there, was not an autobiographical book. I'm fine. My mom is wonderful. She's like a very lovely woman. My parents are still together, blah, 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 normal childhood. But that said, while it was not autobiographical, it was personal in that, you know, it was, I think I was talking to a writer and she used the term emotional autobiography, which I think is a really wonderful way to talk about certain kinds of books, often first novels, in that it plumbs maybe some of the emotions that you experienced, you know, when you're going through a certain phase of your life or certain issues without actually tracking your own life. And so Bee Season came very close to emotional autobiography for me because, you know, it was definitely, I was using my own experiences and perspectives from childhood, what I had seen around me. And so it wasn't, in that respect, it wasn't that hard to write. I mean, I'm a nice Jewish girl. It was about a nice Jewish family, not a lot of research involved in that aspect. I knew those characters pretty well from the get-go. Wicket's Remedy, absolute opposite. I just became interested in the 1918 influenza epidemic out of the blue. I hadn't set out thinking I was going to write a historical book, and I didn't know anything about 1918 or influenza, and so I had to basically build up a book from nothing, from the ground up. And so the first 6 months of working on that book was pure research. I had to find out through my research who my characters were going to be, what my setting was going to be, and then from my reading and those things sort of try to develop a plot. And it was hard, really hard, because, you know, that sounds like a research project or something maybe you do for nonfiction. The big challenge is, how do you breathe life into just kind of this intellectual interest into this, you know, long ago period? And so that was really, really hard to do. But it was from my research that I figured out I wanted to set it in Boston. It was from my research that I figured out that my main character was going to be an Irish Catholic woman who grew up in a tenement in South Boston. And from there.
Great. Wicket's Remedy uses a number of unique techniques to tell this story. The most intriguing of these methods is the sidebar choruses, or as you've called them, marginal voices that are represented as comments printed in the margins of the main text. Some critics and readers have claimed that this method is distracting, while others have found it has enriched the text. I personally felt that it added an emotional depth to the overall story, but it did take a while to get used to. And it required the reader to slow down, which I actually think is a good thing. What inspired this method, and what were you hoping to accomplish with it?
Yeah, the margin notes. They're like, people either love them or they hate them. Like, you don't do in between with these things. But I guess I'm going to back up and talk about the kind of weirdness of it as a whole. I mean, Wicked's Remedy is a book that's made up of lots of different kinds of texts, and the margin notes are one of them. And that came pretty early on. For the first... I don't know, a couple of years when I was working on writing this book, I wouldn't read any contemporary literature. I wanted the tone of Wicket's Remedy to be as timeless as possible, and I knew if I was reading contemporary fiction, that tone was going to infect my own writing, and it was going to feel 21st century and not early 20th. And so I was only reading period writers. And it was while I was reading period writers that I came across the work of John Dos Passos for the first time. And it was his work, the USA Trilogy, these three just amazing books. I think it's one of the total overlooked treasures of American literature. He tells a story using lots of different kinds of texts. He has pretty straightforward narratives intercut with almost like literally a collage cut-up thing that totally predicted and was a predecessor to what Burroughs did with cut-ups. And then he has little snippets of telegraphs, and I saw him using that, and I just thought it was the most lovely way to try to tell a story on a very broad canvas. And I knew that that's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to write a story about a person. I mean, I did, but I also wanted it to be a story about a city and an entire era. And that gave me access to like that kind of broadness of vision. And so it was his books that gave me that idea. And so that's where that came from. The margin notes came from a different source. One of my very favorite books of all time is Pale Fire by Vladimir Nabokov, which looks like an epic poem if you open the book, but it's got these annotations, and the novel, it turns out, lies in the annotations to the book, and I just thought that was cool. I forget when I read that, but it was like, note to self, you might want to try this sometime. And a big part of Wicket's Remedy for me is the unreliability of memory. One of the things that really struck me as I had begun to research the 1918 influenza epidemic was the degree to which it had been just totally effaced from public memory. Because I had first come across the epidemic when it was like the year 2000. It was mentioned in a New York Times article. And so this was before avian flu was on the front page every day, as it's been for like the past 2 years, very bizarrely. So at that point, I didn't know what this epidemic was. And the more I read about it, the more shocked I was that I didn't know what it was, because just quick statistics, because they're just so shocking to me. It killed 500,000 Americans in basically a 9-month period, which is more Americans than died in all 20th century wars combined. And especially in 1918, that is a huge number. And yet I didn't remember, I didn't know what this thing was. No one had ever told me about it. And so as I researched more and more, I knew that I wanted this book to really highlight how you can't trust memory. It's a very fallible and fragile thing. So the voices, what the voices do, or what I want them to do for the reader, is to have the reader experience firsthand that memory is not to be trusted. Usually when you read a book, you trust the voice telling the story. You're like, oh, well, that must be the way it is. And I didn't want the reader to trust that voice. I wanted other voices to chime in to take issue with the main narrative voice of this book and say, no, it was not like that. It was like this instead. And so, is that annoying? Yeah. I mean, like, I definitely can sympathize with a reader that's just like, no, I just want to read a book. What are you doing? And there have been readers that have come up to me and they're just like, I don't know how to handle the margin notes. What do I do? What do I do? And so, this is the advice that I give, which is, it's your book. Like, that's the wonderful thing about reading a book. It is yours. It's a very personal and individual experience. And you can read those notes any way you want. Like, if you're the kind of person that likes to read the end of a book first, like when you're reading a mystery, maybe you'll read the margin notes before you even look at the page. Or maybe, you know, you'll read and then when out of the corner of your eye you see one, then you're going to dart over and then go back to the main text. Maybe you're not going to read them at all. It's okay. I won't know. You know, it's, you can do anything that you want. And my hope is that every reader will determine their own individual way to approach those notes and come up with a way that is smooth for them and has it be an enriching rather than an annoying experience.
I would recommend to readers of this that they try not to pass over them, though, because it's a little bit of a difficult process getting into them. But there's very beautiful moments of tenderness and forgiveness. There's a great deal of the humor in the book comes out of the margin notes. And I love that idea of how it's always, because that's one of the things I picked up on, is this whole idea of how it, you know, it's constantly questioning the reliability of the text. which is kind of interesting too, because you know, the novel will say one thing, and then the margin notes will say, no, indeed, the other, this different thing happened. It didn't happen that way.
Yeah, I mean, I would hope you read them too. I mean, they're there for a reason, and there's actually some kind of crucial plot stuff that does only get divulged in the margin notes. You know, that's not to say that if you read the book without, you won't come away with a different, you know, you'll have a story, but it's not the whole story. So.
And the last margin note actually tells you how it ends.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So if you're going to say, you have to read the last one at the very least.
So I'm going to have to scratch a question here because you got into the collective memory thing. But you also did something even more radical in some ways. You, for the paperback edition, you actually went back and rewrote a considerable amount of the last third of the book. Am I correct?
Yeah. Yeah, this is a very strange thing that I will never ever do again because it's just so unfair. Like, I mean, you've got your loyal reader, you come out with a new book, they rush off and they buy the hardcover, bless their heart. And then what do? A year later, I was like, oh, it's a different book now. It's just like, but I had to do it, and this is why I had to do it. Usually, when you make a paperback, all you have to do is shrink down the page, the hardcover page. That's what they do at the publisher, and bang, you've got your paperback. Because I've got these weird margin notes, it turned out that shrinking down that page would have made the margin notes illegible. So I get a call from my paperback editor one day, and she says, hey, you know, it turns out we're going to have to retype the whole text of Wickets because of those margin notes. Any changes you'd like to make? Never ask a writer this question. It was like, you know, the vampire can't come in unless you invite them and open the door. You know, it was her fault, man. I had turned in my book. And, you know, to be honest, you know, when I did turn in for hardcover, was I happy with it? Yes. Was I proud of it? Yes. Was it perfect? No. Is a book ever perfect? No. But, you know, and I did have this little voice somewhere, you know, in my, you know, inner gut torso region going, is it done? Is it done? And I thought, yeah, it's done. You know, 5 years full-time writing, I've taken this as far as I can go. And sometimes you just have to move on, and maybe I'm at that point. Maybe it's just time to move on. And so I did. But then, you know, I had a year between, you know, when hardcover to paperback happens where I was still thinking about it in my head. And I was thinking about it and thinking about it. And then my paperback editor calls me and says, are there any changes you'd like to make? And I was like, yeah, actually. And the reason I did it is that the paperback is the book that lasts. The hardcover, it comes out, and then it's never printed again, and it's the paperback edition that's printed and reprinted and reprinted. And to know that there were things I thought I could do to make it a better book and not take the opportunity when it was handed to me was just something I couldn't possibly do for the book. I wanted to give my readers, in the long run, the best possible experience I possibly could. And what I wanted to do was so concrete and so easy to fix that I couldn't help myself. That said, do I change? I mean, it's the same story. Like, there are aliens are not introduced. There are no talking animals. I mean, it's the same story. I've just deepened certain characters so you have a better sense of them. There's a couple places in the hardcover where it's very expositional. The narrative voice talks at the reader, and I've converted those into scenes that unwind that get across the same information. So I honestly think if a hardcover reader were to read the paperback, it would feel a little different to them and better, but they wouldn't be able to point their finger at exactly why. The other thing, though, I have to say about this is the last thing I want to do to a hardcover reader is make them buy another book. This was not why I did this. And I actually have a website. It's just mylagoldberg.com. I have posted the revised pages. And if you have bought a hardcover, you don't have to buy a paperback. Go to my website, download. I have a free downloadable PDF of the new pages, and you can just read that and be done with it because I wasn't out to try to get, you know, people to buy another book. That's the last thing I'd want them to do. So,
is your publisher happy about that?
They let me. Yeah. I mean, they gave me permission. I'm not going around their back. And I'm so grateful to them for, number one, letting me do these changes, but number two, letting me help out a hardcover reader in this way. So
that was very nice. B-Season has a strong element of Jewish mysticism at its core, and Wicked's Remedy takes place in a very self-consciously Catholic Boston. Elements of the spiritual aren't as obvious in Wicked's Remedy, but they are there, particularly in the marginal voices. Why does spirituality play an important role in what you've written so far? Do you see a connection between writing, which really is kind of a ghostly art, and spirituality?
It's a very interesting question because I don't consciously want to approach spirituality in my writing. I'm not at all a religious person. Am I a spiritual person? Yeah, but not in any traditional sense in the least. I'm a humanist. I'm like a hardcore secular humanist. And I think spirituality is to be found in humanism, but not your traditional kind of spirituality. I think for me, what spirituality means, which was a major theme in Beast Season, but I think which also is present in Wicked's Remedy, is the desire to rise above the banality of daily existence. You know, each individual's search to make their life one that is worth leading and one that just isn't about waking up and eating some food and going and making some money and then going home. And so that's very much at the forefront of what's going on Beast Season. I mean, every member of that family is searching for something like that. But it's happening in Wicked's Remedy, too. I mean, Lydia is looking for something larger. You know, she wants to transcend her very kind of narrow existence in South Boston. And then she does that, and that still isn't enough. And that's especially shown when the epidemic hits. She's not content to keep with her normal life. She wants to kind of extend herself and try to help in some way. And so that's a major tie to me. And I think you could call that spirituality. The ghost thing, it's spirituality in a sense, I guess. For me, that was so much about memory. And so I guess since they're ghosts, I guess there's a spirituality tie-in. I don't know. But it wasn't in the forefront of my brain for that.
I think of authors like Dostoevsky, who has sort of, you know, they thought of writing, the process of writing as sort of a spiritual madness, mm-hmm. and that, you know, it took them over. So that's, in some ways, that's mm-hmm. what I meant about that, being this ghostly process to actually write something. It's like you're creating new worlds out of your own.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I sort of worship at the altar of imagination and creativity. That's as much my religion, I would think, as, you know, anything else. And so I think there's a definite spiritual aspect just to, because I think to create anything is an act of faith. I mean, to put pen to paper and try to write a story is in many ways an act of faith because you're believing that, number one, someone's going to want to read it. But number two, in my case, that it might actually make the world better in some small way, that someone might read it and it might help them in some weird way, or like make their life a little easier, have them give them a new outlook on certain kinds of people, or just make them think about a new thing, and that in aggregate is a good thing. And that to me is a spiritual act. So
thank you. Myla Goldberg, both Beast Season and Wicked's Remedy have central female characters that seem cast in socially defined roles, but through their own actions break out of those roles and become something else, usually something they or others wouldn't expect. With Eliza from Beast Season, she goes from being an average student to a champion speller, and Lydia in Wicked's Dreams, Wicked's Remedy, goes from a poor Irish sales clerk to a somewhat successful social climber to a very dedicated nurse. At the same time, both of these characters remain reserved and almost placid in their character. What did you hope your readers would get out of these characters?
It's not something I gave any conscious thought to. I don't think about readers when I'm writing a book. I'm just in that world and I'm following mm-hmm. a character around. And I think that's one of the things that you can kind of in retrospect look at, the way that in retrospect you can figure out, oh yes, these are themes that she's interested in. It's, you know, I think I write female characters. Well, for a while, when I was very early on in writing, I didn't write female characters. I think when I was a kid, most of what I read, the interesting people in books were male characters. And so I thought for a while the only interesting characters could be male characters. And it was such a revelation to me when I realized that no, I can write books about female characters and have them be dynamic, interesting people, and breaking out of, you know, their definitions of, you know, maybe what the world or other people want them to be is definitely something that's close to my own heart. So while it wasn't a conscious decision to make them characters that do that, it makes sense to me that they would be people that are doing that. In terms of the reserve, that's a really interesting question that I actually can't answer at all. That's one of those, I mean, the thing that makes writing so great is so much of it, in my mind, comes from the subconscious and the back brain, and it's just stuff you have no control over. And so that's one of those things that's just coming from back there. And, you know, get a psychoanalyst in there to explain to it, because I have no idea.
Well, it's always very interesting, because from a reader's perspective, too, you're always constantly wondering, well, why is the author sort of creating these characters in such a way. So it's interesting to see your approach. To sort of follow up on that a little bit, in both of your novels, the central characters have a sad quality of seeming alone in the world, despite the fact that they're surrounded by family or friends. They're not depressed characters, but they are sad, and the readers respond to that. Eliza especially is a sort of sad character that you sort of want to go up and hug. I mean, she really is emotionally really well developed in that. Why do they seem to suffer from this sort of placid ennui?
I guess that's something else that I just don't really give much thought to, other than that I think the world is a sad place. And so I guess that gets expressed in my writing. And I think that the individual is in many aspects always alone, no matter, you know, where they are. And so I think that isolation just comes from that outlook as well. But again, it's nothing conscious that I can put my finger on, which is a terribly incoherent answer to a very good question.
No, it's not incoherent at all. I'm kind of interested, are there any intended contemporary parallels in Wicket's Remedy? I'm thinking about, as reading through it, it sort of struck me that, you know, we live now in very much a society where people are manipulated by fear. And that's a big quality in this book, especially some of these, I found some of the snippets that you have at the end of chapters where there'll be people recommending, there's this absolutely hilarious one, but it's sort of disturbing at the same time, where the person makes a comment about not wearing too many clothes is a way to get the flu. And they actually recommend that you go around your house naked if you can to avoid catching the flu. But there's that sort of mass hysteria used to control people. You know, I saw a lot of parallels and sort of medical and bioethics and things like that. Was any of that sort of conscious on your part?
Oh, definitely. The interesting thing, the thing about wanting to go naked to prevent yourself from getting sick, that is an actual letter to the editor. Like, there's newspaper clippings that appear throughout the book, and almost all of them are actual newspaper clippings from the period. The weirder they are, the more you can be assured that it's something real that I took from a newspaper. But the thing that was really interesting for me about writing this book is I started to work on it in 2000, and then 2001 came, and then we were at war. And so all of a sudden, and I would been writing about World War I in a world, you know, in America that was at peace and then went to war, and it was very academic at first. And then all of a sudden, I was in a country that had been at peace, and now it was at war. And so it was, you know, from a purely selfish writerly perspective, it was wonderful to, like, be able to actually be in that environment and, you know, apply it to, I wish that I hadn't been given, you know, that new perspective and vantage points to write from. But it was one of the things that saved me, I think. It was very hard for me after September 11th, as someone who lives in New York, for a while I couldn't write. I was like, what is the point in writing? I know this is just a stupid thing. But then I realized that I was actually writing a book that in many ways was dealing with some of the very issues that I found myself and our culture dealing with all of a sudden, and we hadn't been dealing with it before. And so to be able to have an outlet to try to express some of that stuff was very much in my mind as I was writing this book. And so the fear-mongering and just the lies and that people tell themselves and the kind of the mass hysteria that can come up definitely was expressed as I was trying to write this thing.
There's also a really interesting component that I didn't entirely understand in the book, which is the soda storyline in it. Wicket's Remedy is taken a little bit of a spoiler here. Wicket's Remedy is basically, there's a partner for Henry Wicket who's married to Lydia, and he gets the recipe and he turns it into a soda empire. And there's actually a narrative thread that goes through the whole story, and it's mostly takes place in contemporary times, where you get little pieces of memos, sort of, there's a fan club for this soda. And one of the things I took from that was sort of an observation on sort of consumer society, people who are absolutely obsessed with a product. But where does that play? What were you thinking when you wanted to fit that into the book?
Yeah, I mean, for me, though, I didn't want to write a story that was only set in 1918. Having a dual narrative, one that was present day and one that was 1918, always seemed very much a part of what I wanted to do. And this was also wanting to play up the fallibility of memory. I wanted to play off a modern-day Boston Boston against the 1918 Boston to show how much gets erased from, you know, over time and how much just gets totally forgotten. And so having a soda seemed the best way to do that, because what happens is, and this won't spoil, I don't think, Lydia Mary is an inspiring medical student, doctor, who then invents a remedy called Wickett's Remedy. And over the course of time, his partner steals it and turns it into what becomes QD soda. And when we meet up with the soda in present day, it's this kind of pathetic, failing little soda that not many people drink anymore. It's kind of this empire that had its heyday decades and decades before. And so you get the contrast of, you know, it coming into being, what led to its being, and then you get its shadow years and never get its golden age, except sort of in retrospect in this correspondence. And just because consumerism is so much a part of, you know, American culture now, it was just so fun to run with that and play with it. And then also just, it was an exercise using the soda, kind of talks about how dangerous ambition can be and where ambition can lead you if you're not careful. And yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Well, the person who steals the soda recipe, Quentin Driscoll, I actually struck this question because I thought it was kind of silly, but I'll ask it now. He doesn't really get his comeuppance in the novel. And I remember that kind of just sort of, you know, you always sort of in the Hollywood mentality of our brains, we always want to see the villain fall.
Right, right.
And he doesn't. He sort of has a pathetic ending of sorts, but he doesn't do that. Why didn't you get rid of that, Rube?
Well, because oftentimes the people who are, you know, the biggest jerks in life don't get their comeuppance. And I actually feel like his pathetic end at the end of the book is a comeuppance of sorts. It's way too late. It's a comeuppance that he should have gotten larger and much earlier in his life. But when it hits him, it affects him pretty hard. I mean, his end years are not going to be nice ones. And it's something that he brings on himself entirely. And so in that respect, I think he does get his comeuppance. And it's a small one, but I think that's also reflects how things really work. Sometimes it is a small way that someone gets their comeuppance, and, you know, they don't lose the limb the way you wish they would, or, like, you know, get dragged through the mud.
Yeah, I think he lives to 96 or something like that.
Yeah, but it's a miserable 96, yeah, if that's any, you know.
But a further proof that only the good die young. The voice of Eliza in Beeseen Season is, in my opinion, a wonderfully rare and honest literary accomplishment. On the success of this voice, you've commented, the good voice has in part to do with the fact that I haven't quite figured out I'm grown up yet. I remember very clearly what it was like to be a child. Can you say more about this? And have you grown up yet, now with the creation of Lydia Kilkenny?
I haven't grown up, and I hope never to fully grow up. I think part of being an artist of any sort, it's absolutely essential to not grow up in a very specific way, in that it's so important to always be able to look at the world with a fresh eye. And I think one of the huge dangers of growing older is to lose that and just start saying, oh yeah, there's the flower, there's the sun, this is my day, and have nothing surprise you anymore. And so, you know, one thing that kids get to do just because everything's new to them is they see everything like it's new, but I think it's possible to try to hold on to that. And I've made a very conscious decision to try to hold on to that and see the world through new eyes whenever I can, and as early and often as possible. And so in that respect, I haven't grown up yet, and I hope I never will. And, in, you know, I still, you know, my childhood, everyone's childhood informs, you know, who they are and their concerns. And I think I've managed to maybe hold on to that a little more intensely than other people do. That said, I am an adult now, and so I am interested in writing about grown-ups. But I think that, you know, keeping a fresh perspective is going to help me write about grown-ups better.
So. Do you find that your daughter has sort of added to that or rejuvenated the quality of the child in you?
Oh, sure. I mean, how can it not? You see them looking at things and coming up with ways to talk about them and see them that you never would have thought of in a million years, and that's really fun. It's really interesting because I've talked to writers or just artists in general who are frightened of becoming a parent because they're afraid that it's going to limit their ability to make art in terms of their time, or it's going to, like, take over their brain and they're going to have mom brain, and somehow that's going to cancel out the ability to do anything else. But I think it's made me a better and fuller human. And in that respect, I can't help but make me a better writer, because the reason that I write is I'm trying to figure out what it means to be human and, like, all the different aspects of it. And so motherhood has given me a fresh eye on that, and like having this creature that I actually have to take care of and be in charge of and watch. I mean, it's just a dynamic that, you know, is obviously just going to enrich the whole experience of being alive and therefore enrich my writing. So,
well, thank you. At least one critic that I've read has labeled you a bleak writer who doesn't like happy endings. But I found that both of your novels ended with a strong sense of hope. You got to look for it a little bit, but it's there. Both of your novels do have ambiguous endings, but how would you like your want your readers to respond to them in general and their endings in particular?
Right. I mean, I think that's accurate, and I think, you know, it's having a mostly bleak story that does have some hope at the end, but you have to look for it, is kind of my worldview. I mean, I am an optimistic, happy person, but I think the world is a pretty messed up place. And I think it's our duty to find that little bit of hope, but I think it is hidden. And so I guess the books that I'm writing reflect that worldview. And I think books that make things like happier than the world really is, I just don't think are doing a service to, you know, the stories that they're trying to tell, if you're trying to, you know, address the world and address people as they are. So,
great.
Checking time. 5 minutes.
Okay. I have just a couple more questions for you, and then we'll turn over to audience questions. Thank you, Myla Goldberg. This is a question I love to ask authors. Who are the writers you admire, and what are you reading currently?
Right. Well, the writers I admire, I mean, the list kind of grows and changes every day. Whenever I get asked this question, I always blank out, and I come up with something that I've never said before. But one of my favorite books of the past, like, it's just one of the best books I've read in at least 5 years, is José Saramago's Blindness. Portuguese writer guy, won the Nobel at some point, quite deservedly, I don't remember what year. But the thing that was so amazing for me about Blindness, talk about bleak novels, by the way. Blindness is about an epidemic of spontaneous blindness that just starts afflicting a society, and it kind of turns into this grown-up Lord of the Flies, and I love that stuff. But the thing that made it so striking is I read it, I don't know how many years back, and then Katrina hit, and the stories that were coming out of the Superdome was the book. Like, he had nailed it, and it was both exhilarating and terrifying to me as a writer to see that he had plumbed the depths that humanity can, you know, resort to in terrible circumstances. And I was just amazed by that. So that was a biggie for me. Gosh, what else have I been reading? Right now I'm reading March by Brooks. Gwendolyn? Oh, I'm going to mess up her name. She won the Pulitzer. Someone help me here. Is it Gwendolyn? Gwendolyn Brooks? Geraldine. Oh, I'm sorry, Geraldine. I even met her like recently, but I'm the worst at names ever. I'm reading that just this very instant, and I'm really enjoying that a lot. Gosh, what else? Murakami I've read recently and liked quite a lot. Although my newest, I guess, the things that I've been reading and really enjoying that
Murakami?
I read The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle, and then I read Norwegian Wood. But I guess the stuff that's been exciting to me recently in that it's influencing what I'm going to be working on next is I went on a huge realist kick. For the most part, I tend to keep to the magical realist people. I've just tended to like books that mess with reality. But then I discovered Graham Greene. I was like, oh, and so I've been reading a lot of Graham Greene, a lot of Ian McEwan, and a bit of J.M. Coetzee. And I like these guys. And the thing I'm working on now, I'm hoping will kind of absorb that. And I'm trying to do something straight up realist for a change. So,
can you talk a little bit more about what you're working on?
Not a whole lot. It's still really, really young. I mean, and the analogy I've come up with, because I always feel terrible, because I hate, you know, someone asks me and it's so rude to say, no, I can't talk about it. But what it's like, it's when something is just starting out and it's gestating, it's such an internal process. And the analogy I can make is going up to someone in their first trimester of pregnancy and saying, so, can I look at the baby? You know, I mean, you can't just go, whoa, lift up your belly. And, you know, it just doesn't work that way. And I think a similar thing can be said for at least me when I'm working on a new book. So I think it's going to be short and intense and grounded in realism and present day. And those writers are inspiring it. But I think that's as far as I can go.
Great. Thanks. We'll get to questions in just a second, but I'm going to do my quick little rapid fire Q&A here. What's your favorite color?
Green,
okay. That's good. Who's your favorite band?
Ooh. Perennially, I'm always listening to the Velvet Underground, so that's my favorite old band. My favorite new band might be, well, there's kind of two. There's The Books, which are this really lovely band out of Massachusetts, and then Thinkin' Fellers Union. San Francisco band that I'm not sure they're making music anymore, but the music that they made while they made it was just sublime.
Which do you prefer, dogs or cats?
Dogs.
Okay. Why?
'Cause if I want something with attitude, I'll get a friend, you know? Like, I mean, cats are nice because they're low maintenance, and I'm especially appreciating that now, but, like, the unconditional love that a dog gives you, like, that's just, that can't be beat or, like, matched anywhere else, so.
Last question. Knish or pierogi?
Oh, pierogi.
Okay, I agree. Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to be heading into the Q&A portion of tonight's program. Could people want to ask questions, if you could please line up now?
Ask questions. It's so
please
much fun.
Ask questions.
Don't be shy. Don't be afraid of the microphone. Please.
Anyone? That means I have to ask more questions.
Be brave. Once one person does it, then all these people will do it. You'll be, there we go. Thank you.
Just took a little encouragement. I'm curious about your experience with having Be Seasoned made into a movie. Mm-hmm. And how much control you had over the process and what you thought of the result?
Sure. I had no control whatsoever of the process, which was a very conscious decision on my part. It was very weird that all of a sudden there was interest in making a movie. And at first I was just torturing myself. Oh, should I let them turn it into a movie? Is it selling out? Am I allowed to do this? And then do I want to write the script myself or what? And I got really good advice, actually. A writer friend of mine said, look, best case scenario is people see the movie and they're like, wow, now I want to go out and read the book. Worst case scenario, people see the movie and they go, oh, the book was so much better. And, you know, that's kind of a win-win situation for the writer. And what I realized is my primary objective is to be a writer for as long as humanly possible. And having a movie made out of your book really helps you in that endeavor. You know, it brings more people to the book, and for that I'm very thankful. I knew I didn't want to be involved with it, though, because I know too much about how movies are made. And I'm megalomaniacal, and I knew that I wouldn't be able to have this kind of sole discretion over how the movie would get made and how the script would turn out. And creativity by committee is just not something that, other than in music, where it makes a lot of sense to me, the way it happens in film, I just knew would kill me. So keeping psychological and emotional distance was key. And, you know, in terms of how I felt about it, they had their hearts in the right place, and they really did. It's a really, really difficult book to make into a film, as is the case with so many novels. The novel is often a very internal story or inside people's heads, and the big challenge with a movie is to come up with some sort of visual analog to kind of show that internality that a book can do so effortlessly, and that's almost impossible for a film. And so that was a huge challenge that they faced, and I think, you know, they did an admirable job of it, and I wouldn't have wished it on anyone to try to do, and I knew I didn't want to try to do it myself.
I'm a little short. Going for the Orange Julius is my favorite short story.
Oh, gosh.
And I love both the characters, the grandmother and the granddaughter, and I was wondering what your inspiration for that story was and how you came up with that setting.
Going for the Orange Julius, for those of you who haven't encountered it, because it's a little obscure, I'm really impressed you know about that story. It's about a very sick relationship between a grandmother and her granddaughter. And what can I say? Emotional autobiography. As a kid, I in particular, I guess, but I think all kids are, you're very aware of what people want from you and of, you know, what they want you to become or do or how they want you to act, how they want you to dress. And Be Seasoned addresses, I mean, in that way, I think that story is very much linked to Be Seasoned because they're both major themes of just a child who's put in a position where they're aware of something that they're supposed to do and it really might not be the best thing for them to do. So I guess that's my best answer for that. But thanks a lot. Gosh, that's neat.
Hi. You mentioned that you wrote a book before the Bee Season, and you shelved it. I don't know if you can maybe talk about what it was about, if you're ever going to bring it out again.
Oh, sure. I spent right after college, rather than joining the real world, I decided to go to Prague. And I lived in Prague for a year, and man, it was in the early 90s, and that was the best time to be in Prague because the dollar was just incredibly powerful. I was living on $100 American a month, and I was living well, okay? I had an apartment. I went out to eat every night. I was watching movies. It was sweet. And it was in Prague that I was able to actually, like, see what it was like to be a writer for the first time, because I had the luxury of being able to write full time. And it was in Prague that I wrote this first novel, which was called Circus. And it was about the last 5 days in the life of an Eastern European circus at the dawn of World War One or World War Two. I don't, one of them world wars. I wrote it a long time ago. And so, you know, we sent it around, as I said, and, you know, got some really glowing rejection letters, but ultimately I'm really happy it didn't get published. I think that it made me, I kind of consider it my graduate school, because I didn't go to graduate school. Instead, I just went to Prague and tried to be a writer and wrote this first book. And I learned so much about writing from doing that. And I think it's what let me be the writer I was when I wrote Bee Season, which I think was a much stronger first book to kind of hit the world. And I hope it never sees the light of day, this first one. I mean, once I'm dead and gone, if my great-grandchildren want to buy an SUV or something and they bring it out, you know, I'm not going to be able to stop them, and that's fine. But no.
Any more questions, please?
Anybody else? There we go.
Thank you.
I read Bee Season quite some time ago, so suddenly I'm terrified that I'm remembering it wrong. But
I do too often remember it wrong, so we're in the same
so I didn't want to stand up, because what if I'm thinking of a different book? But Eliza's older brother experiments with some different religious experiences. You said you were a good Jewish girl. What made you choose Jehovah's Witness?
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Yeah.
What made you choose that, and did you have to do a lot of research into it?
Right.
Or did you know about it?
So Hare Krishna, when I was growing up, sort of the two big bad evils that were always talked about were communism, because we were still in the middle of the Cold War, and cults. Cults were big and bad and terrible, and it seemed like little kids were going to get snatched away, and like all of them were going to go join cults, like all these after-school specials on it, blah, 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 blah. So, I mean, One of the things that makes me a writer is one of the things I want to do is I end up exploring the things that I'm curious about, the things that I'm afraid of, or just the things that just are haunting me. And so I'd always had this nagging curiosity about cults. It's like, oh, are they really as bad as the people have always said? And so that's where that ended up coming from. And I did do research. This is actually really fun. I went undercover. I live in Brooklyn. And I don't think it's there anymore, but there used to be this big Brooklyn Hare Krishna temple. And so I showed up there one day under a false name. I actually was calling myself Eliza. I remember this now. And I dressed to try to look kind of young and naive and vulnerable. I think I wore overalls and like tried to look wide-eyed as much as possible. And I pretended that I was interested in joining up. And I spent the day being led around the temple and just like being astonished by what I saw, because it was so contrary to what I thought I was going to see. You know, I had the same attitude everyone had, you know, orange robes, carnations, airports, and I thought that was the whole story. And what I discovered is that I think what happened is some sort of reform happened. You know, they kind of had a change of management or something between, you know, the 70s and the 80s, and then this would have been, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000, because what I saw looked and smelled a whole lot more like just a conventional religion. And so I tried to distill a bit of that experience into the writing of the story.
I always wanted to ask, how for Bee Season, how did you come up with that scene in the storage shed?
Right, the whole kaleidoscope thing.
The whole kaleidoscope thing.
Just in case, we won't spoil. For those of you who haven't read it, this won't spoil it. But so there's the scene that comes as a big surprise, something that the Miriam, the mother, is up to. I was as surprised by that as anyone else, which is what, and I wanted to preserve that sense of surprise, which is why I tried to just spring it on the reader and have it happen the way it happens in the book. And I just walked around in that space. I mean, when I'm really in a groove and I've got my world really constructed well, that's what the process of writing is about. The process about walking around in that world and just writing down what I'm seeing. Also, I'm a total movie freak. I'm very, very influenced by the language of film. And so that was a very cinematic scene for me. And so I really was seeing it in sort of cinematic ways and trying to describe it in the most cinematic way possible and just make it about those details and the cutaway shot and then the close-up and the... So.
No, it's a really remarkable scene. And Thanks. It does kind of catch you off guard. You're like, whoa, this answers so much.
Right.
Any more questions, please?
There we go.
You seem evidently like a very interesting character, and I'm just curious as to what composes your personal life. So my question would be, if I were to double click on your life, like how do you meet your husband? What influences you as who you are today? Because you're evidently just so full of energy and life and vibrant, and it's great to see that.
Oh, thanks. I don't know. I'm just me. I've always been a high energy person, which is nice because it means that I can do all the stuff that I want to do. I get bored really easily, so I'm always trying to just do new stuff and feed my head with as many different foods as possible. So I guess, that's a big part of it. I like to just always try new things. This is a really boring, now it's like a personals ad. I don't know. I think it's really hard to ask anyone why or how they are the way they are. I mean, I guess I would hope that my writing would answer that question as better than I could. So I think I'll just say, your answer is just in what I'm writing, hopefully.
I've just recently gone back to school. I'm a graduate student in English literature. And I'm taking a Jewish American women authors class, and we will be reading your book, BC's.
Oh,
I have
cool.
not read it yet. Okay. But so we spent a lot of time, looking at the text and breaking it apart and critiquing it and analyzing it. And I'm just wondering if, as the writer, you go back and look at what you've written and go through the same process as maybe a reader would.
Oh, God,
and kind
no.
of interpret it.
No, I can't stand to go back. I haven't looked at B season since I finished. Well, I mean, I guess I had to look at it when I was giving readings for it, when I was going to bookstores and reading it when it first came out. But that's the only time I've looked at it since. I have zero interest in looking at anything I've already done, because that's just mortifying. Because, it's just that, and also just that way lies madness. Like, you can't just go back into the same hole that you dug and just kind of wallow around in the mud at the bottom of the hole. There's so much else that I want to do that, that would just be such a monumental waste of time for me, I think. But, it's so cool that other people want to wallow in that hole. Welcome to it. That's great. But no, I'm not going to go in there. No way.
This is less about the story, but just to ask you as a writer, how much control do you have over the way the book looks, like the font and the margins and the size and the paper?
Right. That's a really good question. The usual answer to that is most people don't really get any say over that at all. Most writers aren't very visual people. It's a totally different skill set. I'm kind of a mutant in that I think very visually, and I have very strong visual notions. I'm also married to our cartoonist, who's a whiz at Photoshop and also really good at visual thinking. And I also have a publisher who's really nice to me. So I have had a degree of say over visual elements. I don't design my own covers. I don't have anything to do with the innards. The innards of a book, pretty much, you never have any say over. Although, even that, in the case of Wickets, yeah, I take that back. There was a lot of give and take. They were very receptive to, because it's a very weirdly formatted book. It requires a lot of weird stuff. And I did work with the book designers to figure out the best way to show off all the different kinds of texts and make it as legible as possible. And in terms of the cover, I had some pretty set ideas that I passed on to my editor that they did try to incorporate in the cover. But that is the exception to the rule, and I'm very grateful that they kind of allow me to do that and just kind of muck about in what's their business. But usually that doesn't happen.
Do you find that after the success of B season, that you had a little more leverage with your publisher?
Oh, sure. If you have a book that sells really well, they're really nice to you. It's kind of nice. And I definitely have been taking advantage of that. I knew that I could afford to write a really weird second book. If Wicked's Remedy had been my first book, or if I'd had a first book that was lots of different texts and strange margin notes and who knows, what its fate would have been. But because it came after a book that just sewed so well, I had a really supportive base for it, which I'm very grateful for. So, yeah.
Thank you. More questions?
Okay. Well, thanks, guys. This was really fun.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, let's give Myla Goldberg a big hand for her thoughts here tonight. Now this meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, is adjourned. There's also, Myla's going to be signing copies of her books up here. And